Accession number 24193, Reel 18.
Mr. Towell, Reel 18. We're talking about your time, well, you were at Colchester mainly, at Runway Camp from 1954 through to 55. And you were going to be appointed as instructor at the School of Infantry. How did you feel about leaving the battalion?
Well, I was thrilled, of course, because it meant I would get... I was still a senior lieutenant and had some time to wait, I think, to become a captain. But on appointment, it was the... needed a rank of captain, so I would be appointed as a captain before my normal time. It was very much a feather in one's cap, and it could do my career a great deal of good. So I was absolutely thrilled, and I think the battalion was pleased because it liked to have its representatives around. And all our machine gunners from the platoon, and of course right the way across the British Army, would pass through Netheravon at some point in their career. Officers, senior non-commissioned officers were required to pass, and some didn't pass, but required to pass the course before they were permanently assigned to their command of the machine gun platoon. So I was thrilled to get that notice. Then, of course, the other event was that I got married. And I got married to Jacqueline Honor.
How did you manage that? You'd been told not to.
I'd been told not to. On assignment, of course, I wouldn't have to seek permission from the colonel because I was being assigned elsewhere. And I would handle that issue when I got there at the School of Infantry. So I announced the wedding. The regiment came. It was a very satisfying event in the sense that the regiment came, they formed a guard of honour with swords.
This was when?
This was, I think, the 30th of July, 1955. And so the regiment were basically there. We had a trumpeter. My best man was Jonathan Hall Tipping, who later was to command the regiment. And all of my Korean colleagues that were around, colleagues that from Korea and Hong Kong that were around and gettable, came, and it was a great event. We had it outside Canterbury at Barham Court, which incidentally was owned by one of the assassinators of Thomas à Becket in 1197. So there was a lot of history there. We had a great party and the local church, which was attached to Barham Court. And Jackie and I were seen off by the regiment, said goodbye, we'll see you in 2 years' time, as my assignment at the School of Infantry was for 2 years. And we drove to our honeymoon, which was in Caroline Bay Hotel in Cornwall, in the Cornish Riviera, for 5 days honeymoon. And then we reported directly to Netheravon, to Colonel Johnny Frost, and to Alec Parr, with whom I had a 3-week handover. And that went well. It was fascinating. My duties were to arrange the program for both the officers and NCOs. The staff at Netheravon were most professional. They were all members of the Small Arms Corps, which was a specialized corps of the British Army, which no longer exists, but they really were experts in their weaponry, and they handled Warminster and any weaponry activities. Netheravon, with all its weaponry, specialising in the different armaments, and at the Small Arms School at Hythe in Kent, where they really taught you to shoot properly with rifles and so on. These men were all sergeant majors. They commanded at Netheravon. They would command a class, which would consist of about 50% officers and about 50% NCOs. And the class would be about 10 strong, and you would have five or six classes. And that sergeant major was the leader of the course for the entire period. And he would be with that particular class right through the event. So my role was really to handle the program, make arrangements for course for exercises, which of course across Salisbury Plain were considerable, to have various tests operating, which would include tests, for example, with the rangefinder. There would be tests for handling of the Vickers machine gun, of shooting with the Vickers machine gun, the dial sight, shooting indirect and night, and at night. And also then these exercises, which would involve staying out for nights at a time, moving across Salisbury Plain, which is a large area, it's generally very dark, and you'll set tasks like moving to grid reference so-and-so and so-and-so, set up your positions, set up defensive fire tasks, and often they were live in the sense of real ammunition was used. Sometimes we put on displays for visiting dignitaries. The course always was put into a bunker, and the guns, say six Vickers machine guns, were stationed about 1,000 yards away, and the bunker was fired at. I don't think today it would have been allowed, but it was important that the course members could sense the power of a beaten path of bullets landing at the rate of 500 rounds a minute, which is what the Vickers does. And it was very impressive. People came out amazed. Some came out rather pale-faced. And, of course, the strain on the instructor, which was myself, firing, ordering the weapons to fire, was always quite considerable because, you know, could there be an accident? We also were required to go, and in the gaps in between courses, which were not very long, to go and give demonstrations in the British Army of the Rhine, to show our weaponry and our paces to foreign governments. And talking of foreign governments, it is very interesting that a number of places were allocated to students from foreign armies, mainly Arab armies, from the former colonies, like India, like Pakistan, Australia, of course, New Zealand, sometimes NATO, and interestingly, from the Israeli army. And I had one, I think, very interesting time. At the time of the five-day war in the Middle East, or rather just before that, we had three Israeli army participants of the course, and they were very good, very intense, very clever. And at the end of the course, we'd had our party, and they asked me whether they could come and talk with me after the course had gone, and they stayed on for the Saturday, I think. They came home, and they laid out what they said was a theoretical, tactical plan. And they had maps, and they said we were going to do this, and put the machine guns at such and such a place. What did I think of the strategy and the tactics? We discussed it, and we had a very nice lunch, and off they went. The five-day war started, and I recognized some of the tactics of the day. They got on very well with the Arab members of the courses. Jordanian army particularly couldn't. I observed very well that the Jordanian army representatives and the Israelis would get on very, very well indeed. and cooperate, and they were mixed, and they had to carry out certain roles, and sometimes there'd be an Israeli officer in charge, and he would have a gun team consisting of a Pakistani and somebody from Jordan, somebody from Egypt, or vice versa. And it worked remarkably well. Salisbury Plain has, for time immemorial, lent itself to military exercises. And we use Salisbury Plain to its maximum. I would think of the entire course, we probably spent about a third of our time on exercises, marching, carrying, digging, finding your way, setting defensive fire tasks, and always the colonel would tend to visit, the staff would tend to visit, and the relationship with the School of Infantry at Warminster, which of course was the headquarters of the School of Infantry, was very obvious. It's interesting to note that Colonel Turner Kane moved to Warminster and became head of the School of Infantry at the time that I was still there. going back to my matrimonial affairs in the army, by the time I took up my appointment, let us say I was 24 and a half, and there was nothing anybody could do. The army regulation said you had to be 25 before you qualified for marriage allowance. But Colonel Frost gave me permission to live off camp, just outside Netherhaven. So Jackie and I set up our first home in a sort of two-room flat in Salisbury, where we lived in technical sin, as far as the army is concerned, for 6 months without marriage allowance. We then moved to Amesbury, getting nearer to Netherhaven. And then finally, when I became 25, I took over Alec Power's army quarter in the village of Netherhaven, on the edge of Salisbury Plain, and just by the bank of the River Avon, where there was most tremendous and exciting fishing. And I met a very distinguished a fisherman called Tom Sawyer, who is a god in the fishing world, where he taught and developed fishing for trout with nymphs. And a nymph is the rising, emerging fly as it develops, coming from the bed of the water, bed of the stream, up through the water, floating, swimming its way up to the surface, and the trout would then take it. And he taught me to fish. And I was in America somewhere years ago, and I mentioned Tom Sawyer's name, and this particular man who was hosting us at dinner got up, went to his library, came down, and there was a book from Frank Sawyer, signed by Frank Sawyer, that he had actually got when learning nymph fishing from Frank Sawyer. It was a wonderful event. Used to do a lot of shooting. Again, the army did this. It was a way to get yourself known to the brass, the generals in the area. And it was a way, recognized way of just, if you will, pushing yourself forward for your next assignment, because one was always looking for this in your army career. And I was getting very good reports from Colonel Frost. So one recognized part of the event was to be able to shooting pheasant, partridge, etc. And the School of Infantry, Netherhaven, took it very seriously, took the mess silver out on a Saturday in the middle of Salisbury Plain. One had beaters driving, one had, as I said, one had beaters driving the birds towards one. There would be a shooting line, again consisting of all the armies from the south of England and the War Office. And it was a very serious event indeed. Our wives were often with us. So you would have, for example, Jackie is standing behind me in a position on the line. there would be the generals generally in the middle because the shooting was better there, and the lesser officers were on the wings. And you'd have a scene rather like this. A bird would come towards one. A colonel or a general would shout, "Oh, your bird, Towel!" My wife behind me would say, "If you shoot that poor, innocent little bird, I'm going to go straight home." So one had this conflict of one's career, as one saw it, between the general shouting, "Your bird, Towel," and he knew your name, and you were perfectly capable of hitting the bird, and one's wife sulking in the background. And I would sometimes shoot and miss, and, "Oh, what a pity, Towel, what happened? A strong wind this end, oh. Or I would shoot it, "A good shot, Towel," and then I'd have a sulking wife. But it was very interesting. There, as I said, the regimental silver was out. We'd have lunch. Those mess waiters were there. It was almost as though we were in India or in Africa of 100 years ago. It was a recognized event, and we did a lot of shooting. Sometimes we'd walk up through kale. Kale was waist high, a sort of cabbage-like tall plant. And suddenly a partridge would get up from underneath your feet and go brrrr, startling the daylights out of you. And on one occasion I was fired out of sheer reflex and shot two birds with one shot. And I think that enhanced my career enormously. It was a very exciting time. I used to ride with Colonel Frost, got to know him very well. But the 2 years was coming to an end, and I was then asked whether I would go and become adjutant to the 2nd Gurkha Rifles in Johor Bahru, in Malaysia. And at that time, my wife, who suffered a bit from prisoner of war camp and was allergic to sunlight, said to me, well, she would rather soldier no more. And that was a terrible blow to me. And she didn't look forward to spending her life in hotels in Malaya, waiting for me to return from patrols. And in any case, where was one going in the army? So we discussed it at length at home. And then I marched into Colonel Frost and said, I have this dilemma. I think I should leave the army. I was a regular soldier. Oh, and by the way, one was developing a replacement for the Vickers machine gun. And we were all signed to secrecy as to the weapon we were developing. And inevitably, of course, it was with Belgium armament manufacturers. And we would spend our time writing manuals on a new weapon.
What was it called?
It was an FM, Fabrique Nationale. It was a 300 air-cooled weapon. One was signed to secrecy, you know, Official Secrets Act. One had a clamp of 5 years future. And and finally, the weapon was not taken up by the British Army.
What did you think of it yourself? How did it
compare
to them?
I thought it was absolutely superb.
Better than the Vickers?
Oh, yes. It was air-cooled, it was lighter, you could have more of them, it was cheaper. And I think it didn't have quite the sustaining power, but tactics were changing. And already one was getting the impression that no longer were we going to do World War I or World War II or Korean defensive positions, but they would be more adventures in the aid of the civil power, used to be the expression, helping governments out, and the heaviness of the Vickers was one of its problems. So this lighter machine gun, and the tactics, and the measuring of the shots, and the trajectories, and other technical aspects were all, a lot of R&D went on as part of our job.
Now, you were saying you went for this interview with Frost, and what happened?
And I said that, look, I think I should leave the army. I think the prospects are not good. I had just received a visit from Major Murray Pettit, who was at Kohima in Burma, and eventually, or during the battle, he commanded the battalion, that battalion, and there he was, a major and a brilliant soldier, and it didn't seem that the opportunities were very great to go forward. So with that all in mind, and Jackie's comments to me, I went in to see Johnny Frost and talked and said, look, I think I need to resign. I would like to take up some other job. And he said, well, think about it, come back and see me. I went back to Jackie and said, well, I got the first step in. I said to Jackie, what shall I do? I have no idea. I have no training for any civilian job whatsoever. I have, if you would accept it, the liability of a wife and a child. By then, our daughter, Melinda, had been born, an army brat, if you will, because she was delivered at the military hospital just the other side of Salisbury Plain. And so those were my liabilities, and I had no experience at all. My wife's father, in China and in the Philippines, was in the oil business. So my wife said, well, what about the oil business? Well, I knew nothing about it. But I wrote to Royal Dutch Shell, because there was a Shell station in Tentenden, in Netherham, and explained that I had nothing to offer, but I thought I was a good leader and a good organizer, and had a wife and a child, but I could learn quickly. To my utter surprise, they wrote back and said, come and have an interview. So I went to have an interview, still working at the School of Infantry. And they said, look, we'll like you to come back, and back and back and back. And I went finally to a panel of seven in the Shell headquarters in London. And they asked me a number of questions. I think my military career to date, such as it was a significant positive item. And I think getting a military cross, I think, was also very useful. I think it demonstrated to them certain things. I was also a student of of capital raising and the stock market at that time, which I found very interesting, and the movement of commodities. And I told this distinguished panel, which included, I think, psychiatrists and so on, and I was sitting in the middle, being taken apart by all these at the same time. And somebody asked me, what did I think of Shell shares that time and the price? And I said, without thinking, oh, I think they're grossly overvalued. They're far too high, and I don't think the prospects are very good. And I thought, oh, goodness me, that was not an encouraging answer. But they laughed. And finally, they said, look, we'd like you to go to Venezuela, to one of our production camps, and go on the public relations side. a letter of appointment would be coming. Well, I didn't tell them that I hadn't left the army, and so I was in a bit of a panic, so got back to Netherhaven, went to see Johnny Frost, who said, look, I told him that I could be receiving an offer from Shell. And he said, look, I've been thinking about it. Do you know, if I were your age, I would think I would go elsewhere. You're very bright. You will obviously have a good career in the army. There's no doubt about that. I've given you very good reports, as you know. And you'll do very well. But where you end up depends on the future and the reorganization. And at that time, there were all sorts of stories of amalgamations. And on any amalgamation, you know, 50% or a very high percentage of officers particularly, and of course senior sergeants, senior NCOs, would become redundant. So John Frost said he would help me, and he talked to the War Office, and he got me an exemption from my five-year secrecy contract, and I therefore resigned. And it took about 3 months, and I would think at the end of 57, I went to work for Shell.
That was December then?
December, yes.
Now, when you resigned, but what was there any sort of send-off from the regiment or the battalion?
No, because I left from the School of Infantry. I wrote to the colonel, I told them what was happening. I was sorry to go. I'd had, you see, by then, approximately 10 years in the army, having started at a very early age, as I said right at the beginning. So it was 10 years of my life. I was then 27, I think, and it was time to move on. Hindsight clearly was the right thing to do. I kept in touch with the regiment for a number of years afterwards, but then it died, and I, having gone to Shell, and it was very amusing and funny, having spent the last few years of my life going into a room and people would stand and probably salute and be rather sort of deferential, to going to a Shell office in the city of London, and where I was going to learn something about black oils for a few months. Black oils are fuel oil and stuff that drive ships and power stations and so on. And I was asked to get the tea, which I did, obviously. And one had to sign in and sign out. And nobody ever went home as the army did, in peacetime, and you stopped at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the army. You had Wednesday afternoons off for sport. There was none of this stuff in civilian life, and instead of the hours were, let's say, 9 to 5, well, you got there at 8:30, and you were still there at 6. They then sent me to learn Spanish in preparation to going to Venezuela. And having learnt Spanish in a 10-week course, they promptly sent me to Bangkok, Thailand. And I thought, well, I'm just in the same sort of organisation as the British Army, because the British Army did that to one time and time again. So Jackie and I went with our daughter, Melinda.